ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts.
54-53 Memphis. 90 seconds to go in the first half. Pass to Anderson on the right. Fakes the three on Draymond, who ripped it away. It's loose. Memphis keeps, though. Anderson drives into traffic. Leaves it for Clark, who's fouled hard. And now Brandon Clark on the floor.
When it comes to NBA referees, especially in the postseason, it's hard not to think of that old English proverb about children, that they should be seen and not heard.
Oh, Draymond grabbed the front of the jersey. That's a dangerous play.
That's a flagrant one, yeah, is what that is.
That's a non-basketball play.
Throw him out. That's the chance here from the Grizzly fans.
But on Sunday, during a very dramatic Game 1 of the Warriors-Grizzlies series in the Western Conference semifinals, we heard from the refs.
Here we go. Here's quite Dane.
After review, the foul's been upgraded to a flagrant foul penalty, too.
Wow.
Draymond Green has been ejected.
Wow. Dane Fitzgerald made it sound, to me, much worse than it actually was.
We're talking about the face point.
Draymond Green's ejection felt even more offensive than the face slap that triggered the entire replay review, given that the officials had just tossed a star player, the Warriors' best defender, before halftime. But by now, in these particular NBA playoffs, panicking about officiating is also nothing new.
In my opinion, one of the most poorly officiated games I've ever seen in my NBA career.
I asked one of the refs one time, I said, we playing the old NBA or the new NBA?
I've never seen a more inconsistent and arrogant, you know, officiated game.
Coaches shouldn't have to come up to the microphone and feel like they're going to get their heads cut off for speaking the truth.
It's safe to say that across the league right now, things are tense, especially tense. But in the eyes of NBA writer Ben Dowsett, whose beat is essentially NBA refereeing, there's also a lot more to this fraught dynamic than meets the eye.
I don't blame a coach for being frustrated. There are a lot of tensions. There is a huge amount at stake for many of these people. At the same time, there are frustrations building from the other side of things in terms of referees themselves feeling like it's open season on them. Any coach can come out and blast us. Players can scream at us during games. They'll never get suspended for that sort of thing. There are some potential tensions building up from both sides here, and one wonders if they come to a head and kind of collide what we might see.
So today, Ben Dowsett, a bit of a ref whisperer himself, takes us backstage inside the world of NBA officiating to see why everyone is so frustrated, why the league's quest for accountability is raising new questions, and why some teams are quietly redefining what it means to work the refs. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, May 3rd. This is ESPN Daily. Ben Dowsett, I bring you on today's show because I don't know anybody else who's devoted more of their brain, more of their time to studying officials. This is a profession that is regularly and especially right now disrespected. So how would you describe, in short, how the concept of officiating has sort of become a storyline in these NBA playoffs?
Well, Pablo, as we see in certain postseasons, sometimes the noise gets really loud, sometimes it's not as loud. There's certainly some tension right now between the various parties, the referees being one party, players and coaches, I think, kind of being another party there. And you can see in some ways, at least from a very broad standpoint, why these complaints are coming from the player and team side. It's true that foul numbers are way up this postseason so far compared to this regular season, but also even compared to past postseasons. That's very true. We can look at simple data to find that. And then, of course, there's the qualitative side of things where we've had multiple coaches speaking out about this. One of these instances we saw was Monty Williams, head coach of the Phoenix Suns, being fined $15,000 for complaining after a game about a major imbalance of fouls between his team and the New Orleans Pelicans.
I'm going to say this, 42-15 in free throws. You can slice it any way you want to. In a playoff game that physical, that's amazing, okay? Coaches shouldn't have to come up to the microphone and feel like they're going to get their heads cut off for speaking the truth.
And Ben, like, Monty Williams is this like mild mannered dude, one of the nicest guys in the league.
Yeah, I found that fairly interesting, particularly, I mean, he was fined $15,000. I don't know that that's decapitation for someone who makes as much money as he did, but it hasn't just been coaches either. We've also seen these comments from players. We saw comments from Joel Embiid, who has long had an interesting relationship with referees, I think, about his own perceived lack of calls on some of the contact that he gets.
Is it fair to say that you thought there should have been a few more fouls called?
Well, I'm going to take my own advice and not complain about fouls, but they did a great job. You know, I admire the job that they did today.
Can I infer that the job was to make sure there was a game five?
I don't know, but... You can, I really don't know what I'm talking about, but you can figure it out.
No, Joel Embiid was so passive aggressive in his sarcasm that it just became outright aggressive.
Right. And then he, once again, fined $15,000, which even more so for a player like him who makes the salary that he makes, that is a drop in the proverbial ocean. And you can understand why some in the refereeing world are sitting here thinking, boy, there's not really much dissuading people from just going out and taking whatever shots at us they want.
Yeah, Ben, I mean, the testosterone is just surging, right? Draymond is taking shots after getting ejected on Sunday. He's actually doing jumping jacks off the court when he's thrown out, dancing into the tunnel, only to reemerge, by the way, right after the game, which the Warriors wind up winning by one, with a new episode of his podcast, obviously, where he gets even messier.
I am dumb enough to think that the playoffs are a little tougher and not as soft as the regular season, you know, and you can bump a little more and you get away with a little more, you know. Like, I think tonight was probably a reputation thing more so than a hard foul.
But now what I want to do is actually lean in on what you do personally really well, which is actually take a data-driven, empirical approach to analyzing what's really happening here beyond the anecdotes and the hormones. So how have you been measuring all of this?
So, okay, we can start out, Pablo, with the simplest theme, which is how many fouls are being called. And we can certainly compare that to any period of time. We can compare that to this past regular season, where the number is way up. We can compare it to past postseasons, where the number is up a bit. I don't know about way up, but it is higher than we've seen in some recent postseasons. However, there are limitations to that kind of an approach. And folks in the league's officiating department would absolutely tell you that there are major limitations to that. The game tends to get more physical as the playoffs start. And in fact, I think that's been really notable this year. There's been a huge increase in physicality in the playoffs. For that reason, at least for me, I like to try and dive in a little further and look at some of the particular nuances of this. Where I do think they have a reasonable gripe is we saw non-basketball move emphases enter the league at the beginning of this season. Those were emphases meant to actually return refs to calling more of the original rule book, stopping players from jumping 3 feet out of the way to draw a shooting foul, stopping players from kicking their legs out to try and draw offense or to try and draw fouls on the defensive player while they run by. All those kinds of things that were clearly not natural basketball moves, and the league wanted to eliminate those. At the start of this season, they did a very good job of doing that. And one proxy we can look at, it's not perfect, but a proxy is three-point shooting foul rate. Because a number of those emphases spoke, at least in large part, to three-point shooting fouls. And the league wanted to curb how, and in part, how easy it was to draw those. Early on in the year, we saw major drops. The level of three-point shooting fouls drawn for the first few months of this regular season were about half that of last season. Huge drop. That's a major impact, obviously, that the rule emphases are having. However, over the last few months, those numbers have begun to tick up. And getting here into the playoffs, those numbers are right back what they were last season. Not last season's playoffs, but last season's regular season. That's concerning. And I think that's something that the league is going to have to address. The fact that they put in these emphases, and they seem to work really well at the start, but as some people forecasted, they sort of wore off.
And like Chris Paul himself, for instance, one of the smartest, savviest veteran point guards we've ever seen in the game, basically came out and said as much.
It's like the old NBA, ain't it? Yeah. You know, I asked one of the refs one time, I said, we playing the old NBA or the new NBA? I was fortunate enough to play in both of them, you know what I mean? So we just got to figure out which one it's going to be.
Yeah, his comments were really pointed to me. In fact, I think those were some of the most spot on comments that we've seen from anyone in the league. Are we playing under the rule emphases they had for the first part of this season or under what had been the last several seasons before that? I think that's a legitimate question. And questions like those, particularly when they can be backed up by legitimate data and those kinds of things, those are the conversations that need to be had and that are worth having.
The other conversation I do want to have here early on with you, Ben, just in fairness to the people involved here, the least paid people involved here specifically, can we just talk about how impossibly difficult it is to actually try and referee an NBA game?
I personally, and folks could debate this, this is subjective, I believe, to some point, but of the major North American sports, I don't think it's close that basketball is the most difficult sport to officiate.
Yes.
From the dynamic movements of 10 players at once, they can move in any direction. It's not as stasis as a sport like baseball or football. There's not as much space to cover as a sport like hockey, where it actually offers officials more room to see and things like that. I think basketball is by far the hardest sport to officiate. Not only that, but the fans are right next to you in a way that they aren't for these other sports. The crowd's screaming in your ears. The athletes are the best in the world, which is, of course, the case in all other sports. The league, in fact, knows this. They're aware of the pressures that are on its referees, and they actually enacted a new mental health program for their referees that began in the Orlando bubble, came about kind of organically, where referees have access to a number of psychologists and resources for them. I think that's fantastic from the league, but it speaks to just how much pressure is on these people. They are only ever noticed for the things they do wrong. Have you ever heard a broadcast say, you know, I just want to point out the great performance of these officials in this game tonight? Not a once. You have never heard that. So yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that, because as someone who's, you know, ref adjacent and ref sympathetic, I don't think they get anywhere near enough credit for doing a very, very difficult job under the highest pressure possible circumstances.
No, Ben, I've never heard someone point out that, hey, this referee did a really good job of applying a standard that is supposed to change based on who is committing the foul or being fouled, based on the time of the game. Is it the end of it? Is it the beginning of it? Based on the stakes? Like, basketball at its best is asking referees to make calls that are not, by definition, consistent in theory at all.
So that's essentially quote unquote game management that you were just talking about. Yes. The idea that, hey, in certain situations, you can't call this because it's, you know, or with a certain player, like you can't give that whistle to that guy or something like that. The league has tried wherever possible to move away from those. I'm not going to sit here and claim that they've had 100% success with that, because I think that's ridiculous. For instance, we could look at very basic data on they never call defensive 3 seconds in the fourth quarter ever, whether the scale is moving or whether it's not. Attempting to apply that to the very best athletes in the world, who, by the way, train regularly to try and trick you. James Harden spends a lot of time figuring out how to do stuff that our refs aren't going to be able to notice, or how to make them see something in a certain way. Being able to constantly keep up with that, and the research that referees do, I think folks really don't appreciate the amount of continuous education that happens for NBA referees. So thank you once again for allowing me to just touch on that a little bit, because I do think it's important.
No, I mean, Ben, like, refs are like a downtrodden IRS trying to defend against the most clever tax attorneys on the planet, as in a James Harden, as in a Trae Young, these guys who are engineered to find loopholes. And so, like, what you're describing here with the league trying to get smarter and more rigorous and more consistent about this stuff, such that a foul is not just that quote from Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart about how, you know, I know it when I see it. A foul in that way is kind of like pornography historically. How is data entering how the NBA is trying to train up the refs?
That's been another huge part of the NBA's innovations over the last, I would say, 8 to 10 years or so. Technology has become a huge part of this. Until, frankly, the earlier part of the 2010s, much of referee analysis, development, training, their communication with their supervisors, all that, it was done in a pre-digital age. It was done via email, VCR, tapes. The league itself didn't even go to three officials until 1988. I don't think most folks are aware of that. There have been a number of developments over the years. Today, that's completely different. Today, the NBA has what's called the Game Review System, abbreviated GRS, which is a technological platform via which every single game and every single call made by a referee is reviewed at an incredible level of detail. It takes one reviewer an average of 6 to 8 hours to break down a single game. That will be broke. They will be breaking down all potential calls or non-calls in that game and grading whether infractions took place on those calls. In many cases, that process will then repeat another time by a senior reviewer. So many NBA games here will get between 12 and 16 hours of review. And then from there, all of that data becomes a part of the league's massive data set, which I'm told includes over 500,000 data points within just a single season, and often far more. Something that I think a lot of people don't know when talking about refs is the fact that it is possible for referees to be fined for certain misapplications of the rules. It is possible for referees to be fired. It happens somewhat regularly. The league will not release that particular data in terms of how often referees are actually dismissed for not meeting performance thresholds, but it does happen. Also, the playoff assignments, finals assignments, crew chief assignments, promotions from the G League and or WNBA into the NBA, because those leagues will often have significant crossover between referees. All of that, this data plays a role in that. It's not the only thing, but it plays a role in that. So when folks talk about referees being accountable, they should know that at least from an internal standpoint, they're held highly accountable. You can make a lot more money as an NBA referee if you ref four rounds of the playoffs, including the finals, than if you don't make the playoffs, which over half their roster of referees does not make the playoffs each year. That's a pretty good incentive for most people, I think, making more money. Now, there are some who have questions about why isn't that more public?
Yeah, no, Ben, the question that I had, you know, the other buzzword that matters to me is not just accountability, but transparency. So where are we on the transparency of all of this?
So I think that's a big question from the league. For instance, they often get asked, why don't you just release this full data set, whether to the teams, whether to the entire general public? Why don't you just do that? The league's response there is, to what point and purpose? What is the actual benefit of the public having access to the accuracy rankings of all the refs, which, by the way, the league will remind you is a very important thing for referees, but is not the only quality that matters in referees. Just the simple, how often did this referee get the call right? Yes, that's a huge factor, but things like their communication, how they control a game, whether they're approachable by players and coaches, all those things matter as well. And I do think there's potentially room for them to open things up more than they have. Teams get partial access to this data. They can, in fact, teams get access to all of their own games. They don't get access to other teams' games, but all of the call data from their own games. And what I've found in talking to both people with the league and people with teams is the teams who get the most out of that are not the ones who try to use that as a stick, if you will, in the carrot and stick metaphor, a punishment, a way of sending to the league, hey, this guy keeps getting our calls wrong, punish him. Rather, the ones who have the most success with it are the ones who use it as a way to learn, use it as a way to track tendencies. Yes, you can let the league know about certain trends if you're seeing them and work with them on getting them corrected. But to me, and to a lot of folks that I've spoken to, the real use of this is to improve everyone's understanding of the entire system. And of course, within the NBA, to improve the referees as much as possible. That's the key goal of the league, is to make the officiating system as good as possible.
You know, Ben, I can't believe I'm about to quote another Supreme Court justice here on this podcast, but I do think of Louis Brandeis here, who once famously said that sunlight is the best disinfectant. And the one area that needs that disinfecting, that needs transparency more than any other at this point, feels like sports betting. And I want to get into that part of the story after the break.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Ben, it does feel important to remember here that the NBA does happen to be the league that had the most significant gambling scandal of my lifetime, at least.
involving a referee. And that referee, of course, is Tim Donaghy, who pleaded guilty to transmitting wagering information back in 2007, this giant bombshell story. And the NBA now, notably, has embraced legalized gambling. And the gambling industry is just getting bigger and bigger as we speak. So in that context, how do concerns about transparency and legitimacy, how do they factor into how the league supervises and discusses officiating?
That's 100% something that the league is thinking closely about. We've talked about the technology that they're using, the review system they have, and the data they keep. They have multiple employees in Secaucus whose basically sole responsibility is to view that data through the lens of Vegas's gambling lines. And I don't know every technical detail of it, but from the details that I do know, I think it would be very, very hard, if not close to impossible, for someone to pull off another Tim Donaghy scheme, at least in a way that made them any money. Sure, if someone was doing it and betting $20 a game or something like that, maybe it might be possible. But at that point, what's the incentive for a person, you know? So I think this is an area in particular that the league has been very concerned about for obvious reasons. And I think for the most part has done a good job of addressing it.
Yeah, I believe that the league absolutely sincerely wants to get ahead of the next scandal. But the question that is logical, Ben, about all of this now is just whether this entire effort has actually been working in terms of improving the quality of refereeing.
And that question, Pablo, honestly speaks to some of the difficulty in discussing this entire realm. Referees and how they relate to players and how they relate to their leagues is, you ask that question, has this worked? Has that made a marked impact on the quality of officiating in games? I don't know that I have a great way to answer that. I can speak to people anecdotally. I can talk to people in the league, and there are some who think, yes, it's improved significantly. And there are some others, including major figures who are well known in terms of executives and decision-making figures for teams, who will say, no, it's never been worse. This is as bad as it's ever been. Those people aren't necessarily always reliable. They have biases, of course. But what data can we look at? What objective resource can we look at to say, yes, definitely NBA refereeing has gotten better because of this? I don't know that there is one.
Yeah, there's this very strange paradox about caring about something, investing in something so much, knowing that it's a problem that you have to solve, and yet not actually being sure that you're solving the problem. And so the question next, my curiosity leads me to, like, how do the officials feel? Because they're now living in this kind of surveillance state more than they ever have. And how are they feeling as they are being scrutinized to a degree that has been unprecedented?
I will say that it's a kind of a double-edged sword. On the one side, something I've found about NBA referees to a person among those that I've spoken to, they're extremely dedicated to this job. I think you have to be to reach this level of officiating, which, as we've discussed, is such an unapologetic job in so many ways. And I think within that sphere, a lot of refs actually enjoy the resources they have, and even maybe the level that they're scrutinized to. They want to be able to show that they're doing a good job, and they want to be able to prove it in a sense. At the same time, I do think there is some tension in certain areas, and particularly as it bleeds over into the way that they're constantly under attack from people in the league, players and coaches making comments to the media about them, teams sending long, never-ending reports about all their problems with the officiating, which that happens every single postseason and is often at a fairly incredible level, honestly, in terms of just the volume of stuff the league is receiving from various teams complaining.
Yeah, for people who don't realize how it works behind the scenes, NBA teams, GMs will send, like, incredibly angry Yelp reviews of the referees to the league office complaining about how much they hated the food and how much they got food poisoning as a result of it.
Yeah, between that, the stuff that's in the media, the entire sphere swirling around, you do get the idea that at some points refs are feeling like, hey, we're isolated here. We're our own party and everyone is against us, while our only goal is to do the best we can and be the best possible stewards for this game. We don't view ourselves as in opposition to anyone else. We're trying to call a fair game, make the game as great as possible. And the only times we are ever discussed for doing so is in the most negative light possible.
Yeah, all of that sounds fair, Ben. And all of that also helps explain, I think, why teams have begun relying on a secret weapon in order to get the calls they want. And that's after the break.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live. Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom. Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, Ben, hearing you talk about modern refereeing and the influx of data and all of the investment and the money that's going into this, it does establish that this is now just big business straight up. And there's another company that you've been reporting on that I need to ask you about here called Third Side Coaching. Who are they? What do they do?
Yeah, so Third Side Coaching is a company that's run by two former officials, one in the NBA. His name's Don Vaden. He's well known to a number of people in the NBA. Spent about 15 years as an on-court referee, worked the finals in 2002, and then spent about another 15 years working in both the NBA and WNBA management areas in referees. He was the director of both leagues at one point, so a very influential person in both those departments. The other person, and actually the owner and founder of Third Side Coaching, is Shelly Russi, who spent 20 years as an NCAA Division I referee and then also spent time in the WNBA alongside Don Vaden. But in their time since leaving the league, they have entered another industry that I think is really, really fascinating, and that is the industry of referee consulting. They work directly with a number of NBA teams and players, including often on a direct embedding basis, where both of them will come to the city that the team plays in, spend time at their practices with their players and coaches, the whole gamut. And they work with their clients on the entire realm of refereeing, what referees are looking for on the court, how they're trained, how to communicate with referees. The line that I used when writing about them was, major corporations hire former hackers for insights on cybersecurity. NBA teams hire Third Side Coaching to learn more about referees because they've got that experience. They help people see things through the eyes of a referee. For instance, they'll often go into the angles that a referee is at from their mechanics. Referees are taught to stand on certain places on the floor. And based on where the player is on the floor, what's the referee able to see? What's the referee's angle? How can you make the illegal contact that a defender is performing on you most noticeable? Those sorts of things. This service is something that I think is really interesting and is causing teams to realize, hey, there's a real cost if we don't understand these things. The referees, like it or not, are a big part of this game. Our understanding of how they operate and how to play the game within the right confines is extremely important. And both Don and Shelly have been able to provide enormous value to several teams and players through that.
Are they fundamentally, in all of those things, teaching people how to then game the system?
That is one thing that both Don and Shelly and a number of the people they work with would stop heavily short on. They're very clear that this is not about manipulating refs. It's not about gaming them. It's not about trying to trick them. It's about exposing the illegal defender properly, or exposing the illegal offensive player if the offensive player is playing. Don says in my story, we never teach flopping. We never teach embellishment. That's a really important crux point here. And I know for some people listening, they're going to say, hey, what's the difference, really? I do think there is a difference. There's a difference between teaching, hey, if you do this, the ref is never going to be able to see it and you'll trick him, versus, hey, the referee is taught to stand here and is taught to look for this, this, and this. The first thing they're looking at is your footwork, for instance. I'm just making up an example off the top of my head. So here's how you can change your footwork. You know, if you put your dribble down a half second earlier, you won't be traveling when you come off your pivot foot. Very simple things like that, where they tell their clients the truth. They tell them, hey, you're fouling too much in this particular area. You need to do this, this, and this to try and work on that. They're very straightforward with their clients, but they are never approaching this from the standpoint of, we're going to try and trick these people. Because frankly, they have a ton of respect for officials and for the NBA's officiating department themselves, having spent the amount of time that they did in it.
But there is indisputably here like a cleverness, right? These are tips and tricks. Maybe they don't feel comfortable with talking about how this is manipulation, but clearly players are hiring them to get better at getting the results they want. And also, what kind of players are we talking about here, Ben? What kind of caliber of guys? What are they actually learning?
Third Side's coaching work runs the absolute gamut in terms of quality of players. One of the leads of my story was Onyeka Okongwu of the Atlanta Hawks, second year big man. Well, he's not so established just yet, but he's an up and comer. They've worked extremely closely with him, plus several other guys on the Hawks, John Collins, Kevin Huerter, Bogdan Bogdanovic. But then there are a number of very well-known star players that have worked with these guys. Jaren Jackson is quoted in my story. They've worked with Donovan Mitchell of the Utah Jazz. And perhaps the most notable is the work that they've done with Damian Lillard. And Dame talked to me in particular about how as a pick and roll player, which Dame is one of the premier pick and roll players in the NBA, he shoots a ton of threes coming out of pick and roll. That might be the thing he's most well-known for, is coming around that pick and firing up. And he talks about being shown the angles that referees are at, how they can see the plays that he's making, how he's able to expose the illegal contact when it's present from a defender in a way that the referee can see. Dame also talked about the defensive side of the ball. How can he get over screens without fouling? How is he able to legally use his body? And what are the areas where he's not able to legally do so?
So we've been talking about how all of these players now are learning to adapt to referees, and referees are learning to adapt to this surveillance state, to all of the new scrutiny that they're getting from the league office. And meanwhile, fans, by the way, we are getting frustrated, Ben, also by having to sit through these interminable replay review periods where we get referees staring at monitors like they're our grandparents trying to operate an iPad. Like, how does that get better? Where does all of this go in terms of solutions on the horizon?
I think the biggest answer for you there, Pablo, is technology. You talk about particularly about certain areas that tend to annoy fans, really long reviews, endless, you know, the final 5 minutes of the fourth quarter feels like it takes 45 minutes in real time. Sometimes it actually does in real time. That's nobody wants that, including the league, by the way. There is some technology on the horizon. Both the NBA and WNBA have played around with this, though there are potential collective bargaining issues. Who knows when we may actually see this? But there's technology that could play a major role in this moving forward. For instance, I talked to a number of referees and they tell me almost to a person, the hardest call we have is goaltending. We're way down here. The ball's way up there. Sometimes we're blocked by the backboard when you're supposed to be the ref who's calling goaltending, that sort of thing. It's just very, very hard to get right. There is technology out there that, if it was adopted, could automate goaltending calls with basically 100% accuracy instantly within an NBA game. And it would just be a buzzer of some kind. If there was goaltending, it would go off. If there wasn't, it wouldn't. The same kinds of technology may be able to help and automate certain other areas that refs are currently responsible for, that if you remove those from their plate, I think it would make their ability to manage the whole game significantly better. Plus, would make things way better for the broadcast and for the fan at home. So I'm talking about things like out-of-bounds reviews. There are programs now with the type of tracking we have available that would allow for a computer vision program to find the correct call on an out-of-bounds call, even if it couldn't be seen properly by the human eye using slow-motion replay. So instead of a ref needing to go and spend 10 minutes on a challenge figuring out whether the ball was out-of-bounds or in-bounds, a computer program could do it instantly for them. A computer program could replace the referee's responsibility of starting the shot clock and or game clock on certain possessions or in certain situations after made baskets, things like that. So these, in many ways, this sort of tech would kill two birds with one proverbial stone. I don't want to sit here and watch a bunch of reviews constantly. Streamline this. If there's the possibility for that, and I do think there is within the next maybe half decade or so, I think that's one of the biggest areas we could see in terms of both the fan experience and the actual efficiency and quality of the referees.
But do you then see possibly, you know, this killing the human element, Ben? Where are we on the robotic referees?
I don't think it'll ever get that far. You know, we talked earlier about, I think basketball's the most difficult game to officiate because of the simple dynamic nature of it. I also think that means that at least and who knows, technology could go a lot of places, and I'm no expert. I'm no coder or anything like that. But from what I know, it feels like we're a long way away from any type of thing where a computer program could accurately make all the calls needed to be made in an NBA game. There is so much nuance to it.
And also, Ben, to be honest here, it's just a lot less fun to hear from or yell at a computer. So thank you also for bringing your human element here to ESPN Daily.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.